Well, if you had your Bible open still, then I'm just going to launch straight in. As I said, Gideon was a scared and timid man when we first meet him, but he was commissioned with the destruction of this vast Midianite army. And it was not his job only to inflict heavy losses, but to destroy them. That's what he was called to do. They had utterly subjugated God's people, the Israelites. And if you would like, I would like you to turn to Psalm 83, because this psalm sets something of the scene for us. This is a psalm of Asaph, but he references the very passage that we have read about. And it reads like this. O God, do not keep silence. Do not hold your peace or be still, O God. For behold, your enemies make an uproar. Those who hate you have raised their heads. They lay crafty plans against your people. They consult together against your treasured ones. They say, come, let us wipe them out as a nation. Let the name of Israel be remembered no more. For they conspire with one accord. Against you they make a covenant. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. Asher has also joined them. They are the strong arm of the children of Lot. And then listen. Do to them as you did to Midian, as to Sisera and Jabin at the river Kishon, who were destroyed at Endor, who became dung for the ground. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeb, all their princes like Zeba and Zalmunna, who said, let us take possession for ourselves, the pasture of God. O my God, make them like whirling dust, like chaff before the wind. Now, I just wanted to read that because there was genuine evil intent in the invasion of the Midianites. I think sometimes we get trapped into thinking that God can be a bit harsh. 120,000 people dead, and then another 15,000 after that, we read in our passage. But you see, these people have set themselves up to destroy God's people and take his land that he promised to them. So, Gideon is told no less than 5 different times in the passage about him, I will give them into your hand, is what God says. I will give them into your hand. Now, that does not suggest leniency, but destruction. So, despite their numbers and despite the pride of their kings, and the unstoppable ease with which they managed to raid the land, they were utterly routed. God, as you might remember, used Gideon's 300 to engineer such chaos and mass confusion that in fact Gideon didn't have to do anything, really. Once he'd broken those jars that held the lamps and blown the trumpets, they did all the hard work on themselves, running out into the dark in panic. All the Midianites slaughtered one another. You see, I think despite having some of the greatest resources of their day, and like a huge demonstration of military might, God had decided that enough was enough. And what could anyone do? He just implemented divine justice. And the confidence of all of those men and those kings was just swept away into nothing. And immediately, I just wanted us to see that that can be applied into our own lives today. We might wonder, what on earth have we got to do with this ancient bit of history? What's that got to do with us? But you see, we inhabit a world where many live like kings, don't they? And we can feel like we're under the heel or under the influence of not just millionaires these days, but centibillionaires these days. And these vast holding companies and corporations. I read that Apple's annual gross profit for 2024 was $180.6 billion. And you think, well, that's more than countries earn, isn't it? How on earth? And so they've got these resources today, able to bring other countries to heel with economic sanctions, even just writing a bit of computer code. And so we're still in a world where people operate as though they are emperors and kings. Ever since the Tower of Babel, in fact, human beings have been trying to live like kings, as though they rule the earth. For a little moment, like these Midianites, they appear to make it to the top, and they've got it. But you see, you can align yourself to people who sit on thrones if you want, but they're just men and women like you and me. And even if they can command armies or the flow of global finance at a click of God's fingers, everything evaporates from them. Now, I'm saying all of this because it clearly shows us that humans have got a core problem. We all have. King-likeness, if I can use that phrase, is not only demonstrated by the rich and the powerful, but you see, it's in the heart of all of us. We want self-rule, don't we? We imagine that we can establish it. At the coronation of King Charles III, do you remember the people with the placards? Not my king! It just speaks of a desire, doesn't it, for self-determination that's hidden deep inside humans. When Jesus was sentenced to death, the Jewish leaders called out among the baying crowd that they wanted him crucified, and Pilate said, for the umpteenth time, shall I crucify your king? And their reply was, we have no king but Caesar. They couldn't stop the sign on the cross, though, that said, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. What I have written, I have written, said Pilate, didn't he? You see, they and we can't bear to have someone telling us that we are sinners who do wrong. We don't like it. We are wrong before a holy God. Rather, do away with him, our hearts cry out. And if we'd been in the crowd as Jesus was being crucified, we would have shouted it. I'll choose my king. I'll choose the one that suits me, is how we think. I'll be my king. And this is the diagnosis of the human heart. But there's a problem with that, because God did not create man to be kings. The mandate in the Garden of Eden was that we would be stewards. It's very different, isn't it? We would work on behalf of God, to his design, not rule as though we were the kings ourselves. And I want to say this, the king, the true king, is the God of the Bible. And whether you think you serve him or not, whether you believe in him or not, whether you metaphorically wave a banner that says, not my king, it makes no difference to the fact that he is sovereign over the whole universe. And one day, either as a rebel or as a citizen of heaven, you'll bow before him, and he is the final word over all time and eternity. And so it was in Gideon's day. King Zeba and King Zalmunna probably thought they were unstoppable. But they were as nothing. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain, it says in Psalm 2. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Well, Gideon was up against people like that. But that wasn't all he was up against, because he also had a further problem, as we see when we get to... I'll just flip over again. When we get to chapter 8. Gideon had contended with Baal when he was young and torn down that statue. And then he contended with the Midianites in chapter 7. And now, surprisingly, he has to contend with his own people. It's a bit of a shock. And we see three kind of small vignettes over the first 16 verses of these stiff-necked people who do not want anything to do with him. He called the tribe of Ephraim into helping with the mopping up. But it doesn't go well at all, does it? Because verse 1 starts off with this. What's this you've done to us, not to call us, when you went to fight against Midian? Ephraim, you see, were a proud tribe and considered a leader amongst the northern tribes. They claimed Joshua as their most notable forebear, you know. And then what we see is their nose is completely out of joint, isn't it? Rather than having significant influence over the tribes, they're really put out. Angered by the late call to action and by Gideon's apparent presumption that he could just unilaterally go and take on Midian on his own without consulting them. It's very sad. I'm sure Ephraim had suffered under Midian as well. But is there any praise for what God's done? Are they at all delighted that the enemy has been done away with? That God has stepped in miraculously? Not a bit of it. No praise and no thanks. Instead, they took offense at God's chosen man. After all, remember, Gideon, he was just the youngest of the smallest clan of the smallest tribe. They want nothing to do with him. Should have been us, they're thinking, aren't they? Should have been us. We could take on Midian. What are you doing it for? And so they treat these rude Ephraimites, treat Gideon very badly. And God was right all along. One of the things that he said back in chapter 7, verse 2, was, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. God had them nailed, didn't he? He knew exactly what they were like. He knew exactly what they were going to do. And sure enough, true to form, why weren't we there? We could have done that. Well, we need to be careful, don't we? Pride is a terrible thing. We don't want to be prone to glory hunting. Maybe, you know, there are people who you might meet who want to be where the action is. A bit of the gloss can rub off on me, can't it? Do we spend too long considering the weaknesses of the man or the woman on the front line who's actually doing something? And we think, well, they should probably do it like this. If I was there, I would do it like that. But you see, you're criticizing God's work, God's choice, God's chosen people. He doesn't want people who are overqualified. He never does. He wants the underqualified, the people who don't fit. Because the glory is then his. It couldn't be them who made the success. Now, in our passage, to Gideon's credit, he kind of ignores the insult to himself although he shouldn't have ignored the insult to God and his goodness. But he uses this kind of quick-witted proverb to pour oil on these troubled waters. And he placates them. What have I done in comparison with you, he says. And this is true, of course. Gideon hadn't raised his sword yet. So he didn't look like he'd done an awful lot. He'd only had 300 men with him. It wasn't down to him, and he recognizes that. And we see, don't we, a gentle word turns away wrath. Gideon knew it. And then, keeping on with his task, and having placated them so they're kind of on his side, they carry on in their pursuit, tracking down these two Midianite kings. Now, if Ephraim had tried to behave as though they were somehow in charge, we also see it in these two villages. With some contempt, they say to Gideon, "Should we give you bread? Have you done anything yet? Have you got the hands of these kings in your hands?" "I don't think so." "Go and do your job, and then we'll think about getting you some bread." And they treat him badly as well. The attitude of all these three places, they believe themselves to be the rulers of their own affairs. They wouldn't subject themselves to the leadership of another and disregarded entirely that God was at work in any of this. The last line of Judges, I remind you, says, "In those days there was no king, and every man did what was right in his own eyes." You see, the problem was maybe not so much that they didn't have one king, but there was loads of kings, people who assumed power for themselves. There was too many. And again, is this not the culture we occupy today? We live in a very self-centered, autonomous, individualistic society today. Everyone feels like they've got the right, haven't they? They'll decide for themselves what's true, what's false, what's right, what's wrong. What's right for me is right for me, even if it's wrong for you. It's a bit of a strange way of thinking. They have this phrase, don't they? "You do you. Don't bother me." It stems all the way from the Garden of Eden, doesn't it? Satan tempted Adam and Eve. Did God really say, "You know, you can decide for yourselves. Take charge of your own life. You're not a slave." And it's quite seductive, even saying it now. This idea of being your own person, making your own choices, being free. It's very seductive. We think we could be unshackled by anything or by anyone, and we decide. But it's completely wrong. Completely wrong. We are made creatures. We're sustained by our Maker. We're servants who've been given the right to operate in God's world. And we can operate with great freedom in the name of the King. But if we act as though we are king, that is treason and rebellion. So we've had kings from the outside, these Midianites, people behaving like they think they're kings, on the inside. What happens to these men who would be king? Well, to be honest, nothing good. There's three sets of kings removed from their thrones. In our passage, Gideon captures Zeba and Zalmunna and their 15,000 troops. And it seems almost like another miracle happens, doesn't it? It's still only 300 versus 15,000. But God has not taken his eyes and hand off Gideon. And these 15,000 panic again and flee in all directions, and the kings are captured. And this takes us to verses 18 onwards. And it's tense and brutal, isn't it? This execution. Neither of these two Midianite kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, seem at all remorseful or like they're going to plead for their lives. They're hard and defiant, even, you'd say, in the face of death. And Gideon is unsurprisingly merciless towards them, killing them both. And they kind of almost taunt him into doing so. Did you notice that? As the man is, so is his strength. If you think you've got it in you, Gideon, you come and do it. And yet they were signing their own death warrant. It's how low people will go, isn't it? The Bible doesn't sugarcoat life for us. It's in the raw, isn't it, when you read the Bible? And if you find these moments unpleasant reading, it's because they were unpleasant moments. God is not screenwriting a movie or a play here. We're allowed to see and hear about true times with true people. And this is what happened. Now, some commentators criticize Gideon for this moment, saying that he was behaving like judge, jury, and executioner. However, others suggest that God had commissioned Gideon back in chapter 6, verse 8, "Go in this might of yours and save Israel from the hand of Midian." And then God clothes Gideon, do you remember? In the Spirit of the Lord. Now all this indicates, I think, that God was very much treating Gideon as his divine instrument. The time of the Midianites had come to its end. They had raped the land of Israel. And that brought them under the wrath of God's judgment. This pair of human kings who thought they could just take with impunity, suddenly were gone. Just like that. And they would have to face the living God. So that didn't end well for them. The second set, if I just go back a touch, are these two towns and the leaders. These two towns had refused Gideon bread, told him to sling his hook. But Gideon did come back. And he had had success. We read of 77 men in Succoth being publicly flogged with thorn branches. The men of Penuel killed and their tower torn down. And again, this looks like really rough justice, doesn't it? And we wonder, has Gideon overstepped the line here? What's going on? It could be that he did, somewhat. But I think maybe the simplest explanation is that these people had made a choice. It was either Midian or Israel. They were happy to see Zalmunna and Zeba dead, but they hadn't been prepared to lift a finger to take part in the action of doing it. And by not being for Gideon, they were against him. And being against him meant they were for the Midianites. Their actions were treason. They'd sided with their enemy against their own people. They had rejected again the fact that God was sovereign over their affairs. And so, proud and ungrateful, justice fell on them too. Again, nothing good. And set three, the third one, a fallen kingship is Gideon himself. The people asked, "Gideon, come and be king over us, rule over us." And Gideon says the right thing, because he answers and says, "I will not, and my son will not. The Lord will rule over you." And Gideon, on the face of things, seems to recognize that he could never have accomplished what had been going on his own. What was done through him by God. Salvation had come from above, not from his own hand. However, he clearly makes a huge error of judgment. Maybe flattered, who knows? Gideon takes the captured gold and he makes this ephod out of it, placing it in the city of Ophrah. Maybe he wanted a monument with the best of intentions to God's goodness. A permanent reminder that the high priest of Israel, hence the ephod, had been the savior of Israel. I'm speculating, of course. It doesn't really matter one way or another, because what he had done was he'd made an idol. And it's a curious circle that Gideon completes. Back in chapter 6, verse 27, he's taking Baal's statue apart in the middle of the night. Burns stuff. Destroys it all. And yet here, now, with success behind him, with people praising his name, he's making an idol and building a new one instead. God said, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath." And so, even with the best of intentions, Gideon was wrong. He should not have made something to represent the power of God in their lives. The result was, Israel hoard after it there, and it became a snare to Gideon and his family. They were trapped by the presence of this thing. It did them and no one else any good at all. What hadn't happened with the rescue from the Midianites was a change of heart. And as soon as he died, you could just skip forward to verse 33 if you want. It says, as soon as Gideon died, the people of Israel turned again and whored after the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. As soon as he died, it just seems so shocking. It's not like there's a long ripple at all. Oh, Gideon's gone. What do we do next? Now, Gideon's theology, perhaps, had been right. I just want to make this point. He had said, I will not rule over you, nor will my son. God will rule over you. This is a lesson to us today, isn't it? It's easy to know the right things, but it's far easier to not even do the right things. We all know, I know, we should be praying and reading the Bible as our first priority. But for how many of us do we honestly find that that's actually down the priority list? And it comes and it goes. And our discipline wavers. And we find ourselves distracted. And we're just quick to be careless. It's easy for me to criticize these Israelites. But I'm not sure that we can criticize them that much. You know we're not saved by works. And we're not in a relationship with God where we move in and out of his favor, where you can kind of score points. But we still live like that sometimes. Where we kind of judge that we've done quite a good week this week. I've done this and I've done that. I kept up with all of those things. And we tick off our little tick list, our star chart. Well, we must live by the Bible. This is where truth is, not our own. This is the truth. We do what it says here. Now, I've kept you in the shade for long enough, because that is quite a dark piece of history in the Old Testament. And that whole account just ends on a disappointing sigh, doesn't it? But the whole book of Judges has got a message for us, which is far, far brighter. No human, as you can see, it's perfectly evident, taking power for themselves has the qualifications to see it through. None of us. And no matter how any other nations moved against Israel in those days, and no matter how many people God raised up to fight back against those nations, Israel just kept on going back round and round and round to the same old. And it's easy just to read that and you think, well, humanity's hopeless. We're destined to this endless cycle of rise and fall and rise and fall. Well, are we? Thankfully, the answer to that is no. We're not. All of this points us forwards to a far greater, more solid plan. Remember, in Psalm 2, God reminds us that he laughs at the world's leaders and holds them in derision. But, he says, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. And that king is Jesus Christ. Now, although Jesus is not mentioned, possibly not even alluded to, in the passage that we have read, we're told in Hebrews the whole Bible speaks of him. And so, he becomes conspicuous by his absence. Allow me, for a moment, just to compare him for you to the grasping, selfish, vain failures that littered our passage. If you read the Gospels, you see that God sent his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, as the final king. The King of Kings. A king like no other king. Because he was not a power-hungry despot seeking the wealth of the world. He was not someone who looked for the servitude of other nations. He did not carry cruelty and arrogance and disdain for others in his position. He didn't deal in death and destruction. And he was not a removed, distant figure in a palace that you couldn't get near. A king like no other. Rather, we see Jesus saying he had come to serve, not to be served. We see Jesus, this King of Kings, declaring that he had come to seek and save the lost. We see people running to him in the Bible, crowding round him as he moved amongst them, and he healed the sick and the lame. He visited and met with the poor and the disenfranchised. He comforted those who were broken and were living in disgrace. And yet, he had the authority in every conversation he ever held to be able to speak to both the rich of the rich and the poor of the poor. And he stopped them all in their tracks, challenging them, the core of their being, to face up to the fact that they were sinners before a holy God who was better by far. Is this not a king to be in the service of? You could have had any of these ones before, or you can have this. This is remarkable. We would be flabbergasted, wouldn't we, at any world leader ever behaving in that way. Walking around the streets, being able to give stuff to people who needed it. Not with bodyguards and photographers walking with them or anything like that at all. We'd be amazed at it. But Jesus did it. And more importantly, he proved he was not just an amazing human being, but he went one step further and proved that he was also divine. The God-man. Doing the impossible. Not just being nice and good, but doing the impossible. He spoke food into existence for 3,000 people. 5,000 people, sorry. He commanded the natural world to obey him, and it did. He commanded disease and disability to leave people. And it did. And he restored them to full health. He made the blind see, the deaf to hear. He even spoke the dead back to life. Imagine a world leader today who could empty the hospital wards by speaking in them. Jesus could do it. Then, even more importantly than that, these signs proved that since he was divine, he also had authority to alter the very spiritual nature of people's hearts. As God, he forgave people their sins by saying so. He made them new from the inside out. He's done that for lots of us here this evening. He took their sin's consequence away and replaced it with his own glorious righteousness. How he did that is unfathomable to a normal human mind, because this man, who was God and the King of Kings, full of authority and insight and wisdom and miraculous power and generosity and love and mercy and humility, in every way a perfect king if you were looking for one, he went before a Roman court. He was found guilty of crimes he didn't commit and allowed himself to be sentenced to a horrific death. And he became the perfect king on a cross. The only one supremely qualified in every way to hold that office. And he did that for people like you and me, and anyone who turns to him, who's under conviction of their sin, who feels the weight of it, the guilt of it, who wants rid of it. Out of love, he took what we deserve for free, so that we can be released from the chains that shackle us. And I have to say this, offer to be saved by this king is open today. It wasn't for then only. It is for now. If you don't know what it is, or you feel this burden of your sin, even today, turn to this king in humility. Ask him to be your king. King of your heart, king of your mind, king over your life, and he will make you a royal subject of heaven. And the reward of the new heaven and the new earth is beyond our imaginings. Once you're a Christian, you're ready to inherit this someday. Surpasses Eden. Believers will participate in God's rule and reign, having been granted this position of authority and service and leadership in God's kingdom. That's the promise. And they sang a new song. This is a view of heaven, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." That's what awaits you if you believe in the King of Kings. Absolute, unimaginable glory. And so there is great light, I hope, at the end of the dross of human beings. It is not only a depressing view of the world that we have, but rather there is something far, far, far better. Amen.